Hi, my name is Mike Gibb. I run accountsrecovery.net, and I'll be moderating today's webinar on where collectors make the most FDCPA mistakes. Collectors receive a lot of training on the ins and outs of the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, but nobody's perfect. Today, a panel of credit and collection industry executives will share their insights into how and where collectors tend to make the most mistakes and how to address them. This webinar is being generously sponsored by Peak Revenue Learning. You'll get the chance to hear about them a little later in our program. I want to take a quick minute and say a few words about accountsrecovery.net. Accountsrecovery.net is the news and information platform for the armed industry. The site publishes unique and curated content, maintains a number of email newsletters, hosts webinars like this one, and offers a number of exciting podcasts for the armed industry. The site is free for anyone in the industry to use and is a great resource of news and insights to help educate and inform. I hope you all spend a few minutes every day checking out what it has to offer. Now, let me tell you a little bit about today's speakers. John Bedard is a nationally recognized authority on the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act and Fair Credit Reporting Act. He serves as counsel to several professional trade associations, including the Georgia Collectors Association. John is a former member of the board of directors of the industry's leading professional trade organization, ACA International. He serves as the state of Georgia compliance chairperson for ACA International and is a former chairperson and program designation award recipient of ACA International's Members Attorney Program. Renee Bogart is the vice president of compliance and quality assurance for Radius Global Solutions with 15 years of overall experience in the call center industry. She manages compliance and QA internationally for both first and third party operations throughout the United States, India, Jamaica, and Panama for more than 1,200 collectors and agents. Key responsibilities focus on fortifying the company's sustainability through solid compliance management systems, creation and implementation of policies and procedures, and reinforcement of both through call monitoring and auditing. Shelley Gensmer is the Vice President of Legal and Compliance for ERC. She's been with the company for the past 2 years and holds the Chief Compliance Credit Officer CCCO designation from ACA International and has more than 13 years of litigation and collections experience, ranging from first party, third party, legal to deceased collections. The format for today's webinar will be a panel discussion. We encourage everybody to submit questions and we'll get to them when the discussion has concluded. To submit a question, please enter into the question tab on your Zoom webinar control panel. This event is being recorded and a recording will be made available later today on accountsrecovery.net. As well, I wanted to ask everyone to take a minute and fill out the survey that should pop up on your screen after the webinar is over or after you log off the webinar today. You'll also receive a link via email tomorrow to access the survey. Participating in the survey helps me develop content that is what you are looking for and to find the speakers you want to hear from. As well, one lucky survey participant will win a Starbucks gift card, so please take a minute and participate. With that, let's launch into today's discussion. Let's hit the nail on the head with the first question. And maybe, John, you can take this one first. What mistakes do you see collectors making the most often when it comes to complying with the FDCPA?
Good morning, Mike, or good afternoon. Thank you for having me. One of the things that we're seeing a lot as of late are letter problems. A mistake, I guess, would be failing to have a process for having your letters reviewed and failing to have change control processes on letter content to ensure that the content of your letters gets vetted before they get put into production. I'm seeing that more and more, and letter claims as a result are something that we're seeing in our office as being up recently. Just a few others that I'll throw out there before everybody else mentions a few is not being able to identify when the agent is on the phone with somebody who is trying to bait them. And I know we're going to talk about baiting a little bit later, but training programs that omit training on when you're being baited on the phone call and how to deal with that. The last one I'll mention is studying complaint data, dispute data. I don't see a lot of agencies studying that data the way they could really be studying it. In order to help drive some change through the compliance management system. And so those are the three things that I'm seeing here often and recently.
Excellent.
Did you hear any of that?
You're completely good.
We should have just.
Thank you.
We should have just kept letting him think he was on mute the whole time.
Everyone's stunned into silence by such a great start. Renee, Shelley, anything you want to add on top of that in terms of the mistakes you're seeing collectors make the most often when it comes to complying with the FDCPA?
I absolutely have to like just jump on board with the baiting thing. It's just becoming more and more clever. But I do agree that, you know, obviously we'll jump back into that later. Also, letters have been a huge issue for us as well. And, you know, it's a huge just meaning that, you know, we're not like in the practice of sending out a bunch of crazy pants letters to people and getting ourselves in trouble. But it seems to me that since we've kind of revamped a lot of the TCPA stuff and cleaned up a lot of other items, both industry-wide, you know, as well as internally and through the various laws and regulations being put into place by the state, I think plaintiff's attorneys are getting bored and therefore a lot more clever. So the next thing that they have to pick apart are your letters. But also, obviously, they're focusing and honing in on agents. They're hiring third parties to call in and to bait your agents. They're hiring people to try to trip your agents up and catch them in what would be a perceived violation. I mean, that's one of the big ones. And if I were to highlight any of them, as far as like the top contenders for, you know, what seems to be at the top of the list for us would be disputes. The different ways that disputes can be given, taken, perceived, not perceived, you know, with all this craziness coming out of the courts in Pennsylvania with regard to the DVL language, the validation language that's on your initial communication, you know, having to insist that in Pennsylvania alone that we put that, you know, the dispute is only valid if it's in writing. Which, you know, obviously, in my personal opinion, and dare I say professional opinion, I feel like that's a little bit of an irresponsible stance to take, you know, so obviously we're trying really hard to push back on that. But I think that's just kind of the new thing. You know, for now, Pennsylvania says it has to be in writing, and tomorrow maybe they'll decide, you know, on another case that overturns it all. And do you change your letters? Don't you change your letters? You know, and then to that same point, people that do call into dispute, we have had several instances where someone has called in and said, can I dispute this in over the phone or does it have to be in writing, hoping that the agent will slip up and not honor the dispute, you know, and even being pickier down to saying things like, I don't think that's the right amount. I don't think that I owe that much, you know, and our agents then being combative and replying back with things like, well, then if you don't think you owe that much, why or how much, you know, it's just all, it seems to, I would say the thing that's under the microscope the most right now is disputes. That's just what we're finding. I don't know, what about you, Renee?
If I were to, I kind of examined this question really just from an operational perspective, how do collectors interact with consumers, some standardized calls, and what I find is a lot of times the collectors deviate when they are distracted from their standard process and they miss the disclosures that they need to provide to consumers. So, even in listening to calls yesterday, I hear collectors that have built a relationship with their consumers. So they're calling back someone that they've already talked to frequently, and they're deviating from their normal initial right party contact, and they don't provide the disclosures that they should typically give. So they forget their debt collector disclosure. They're not identifying the client the way that they need to or the company. Also, they get distracted when the consumer isn't cooperating with them at the initial start of the call. So they're attempting to authenticate and someone saying, what do you want? Who are you with? Why are you calling? And they get sidetracked from providing the disclosures and the pattern that they're accustomed to when the call follows the same direction as they were taught in training, their same call opening and their call flow. So I always encourage collectors to stay the course, remember where they were in the conversation, make sure that they're getting back to their disclosures that they need to provide. When they've established a relationship with a consumer, don't get to the point where you're feeling too comfortable, too personal. They always need to maintain that higher level of professionalism. And the other lane was disputes. I was thinking the same thing. You know, we have issues with overshadowing, and so we have to be so cautious within that first 30 days of placement. But then the continuation of dispute issues. My company happens to credit report, so we have issues with consumers specifically trying to ask collectors, what do I have to do to get this removed from my credit, and trying to trap our collectors and saying the wrong thing or providing misinformation unintentionally. So disputes are definitely a concern and offer up a lot of opportunity, both with the FCRA and the FDCPA for unintentional errors.
Excellent.
And so,
well,
this is John.
Yeah, sorry, John.
Hey,
yep,
Shelley and Renee, Shelley mentioned, the Third Circuit and the G notices. Have each of your companies changed your validation notices as a result of those cases out of the Third Circuit, or how has your companies responded to those cases?
We have absolutely considered it, and we've definitely talked about it. ERC, we host a peer group discussion quarterly, and in that discussion, we get the opportunity to talk a little bit with Karen Scheibe, I'm not going to pronounce her name right. She's from the ACA, and sometimes we can get people from the inside arm on to discuss with us too, and just kind of get some outside perspective also from some of our other peers and attorneys, and discuss what their reactions are, both, professionally as well as like within their company. How are you handling this? What do you think? And truthfully, it was a little bit of a relief to hear that much of the consensus was that nobody's changing their language, because there's been such a backlash as far as people crying out, for some clarification or for the CFPB to jump in and take a hold of this, because it's kind of making a mess out of what the current case law actually holds. And the idea of that is that, there's probably going to be a case law that overturns it all. I mean, how many times has that happened? So one thing that we considered, and again, ERC has not made this decision yet, but something we always have at the bottom of our notices is something that says nothing in this letter changes your right to dispute the debt. Maybe adding like a provision in there: if you cannot dispute the debt in writing, call us at, put your phone number, visit our website at, put the website on there, and adding that to the bottom of the letters for everything that's not NPA. I mean, we've tried to kind of go through different various changes or not changes. I don't know. Anyway, we've discussed it. We've definitely discussed it, but we're pleasantly surprised actually to hear that the consensus that we received on our call was that people are not making changes. I am curious what they're doing.
Yeah, I concur with Shelley. We found the exact same results, and at this point, we've decided to continue with our letters in the way that we've already formatted them. The content is remaining the same.
I think that's great for the people on the call to hear what you guys were doing, because I know even a lot of our own clients are struggling with that very issue.
Excellent. Yeah, definitely. Sorry,
well, before we jump into our next topic, I'd just like to pause the discussion momentarily, and I'd like to invite Chris Rickman from Peak Revenue Learning to say a few words. Chris?
Thank you, Mike, and hello, everyone. We are grateful for the opportunity to sponsor today's webinar. Our company provides Knowledge Source, a web-based employee education and compliance training application to companies in the collection industry. Knowledge Source is used by our clients to simplify and lower the cost of training new and existing employees. Our clients are companies that want to build and maintain a high level of assurance their staff members have mastered and are maintaining their mastery of the knowledge expected of them when interacting with consumers. Knowledge Source automatically builds documentation of the compliance training efforts of the company for existing and prospective clients and for regulators. For those of you I don't know or haven't met, I spent most of my career on your side of the desk. I've worked in the collection industry for greater than 30 years, most of that time in executive management of a collection firm. Knowledge Source was created to address many of the shortcomings in training and compliance I saw as COO and CEO of an agency. Use Knowledge Source to implement an ongoing continuous training cycle, reinforcing the knowledge you expect staff members to have before it begins to fade from memory. Present collection client or compliance policies, company policies to your staff members during onboarding training or at ongoing recurring schedules where they acknowledge they have read and understood these policies. Present tests during training events to validate learning or on recurring schedules to certify staff knowledge in areas you wish, such as the FDCPA, HIPAA, and other areas. Use Knowledge Source during training events to present videos or slideshows, audio recordings, followed by a set of questions to validate participation and learning. In summary, Knowledge Source will close knowledge gaps, promote accountability, lower the cost of training, document for prospective and existing clients, regulators, and auditors your company's proactive role in preventing compliance nonconformities. To find out more about us, please visit us at peakrevenuelearning.com. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris. And thanks again to Peak Revenue Learning for sponsoring today's event. A couple of quick questions have come in that I want to address before we move on, while they're still sort of top of mind. Shelley, I think this one's for you. Did you say that firms are hiring third parties to make calls for call baiting? Is that something you said?
That is absolutely correct. Yes. Actually, and I don't mind expanding on it. It's actually one of my favorite things to talk about. just because it's gone, it's just honestly, like, you know, when you get transcripts from depositions and from hearings with judges, you know, you almost tend to cringe and don't really want to read them, or you already don't care and kind of just like file it away. But we printed some of these out because it's just been wildly entertaining. And it's public information, so I'm okay with sharing it. I'll just use one case specifically. We had an attorney out of New York that hired somebody by the name of Wanda Fraser. That's not her real name, but that's the name she went by, to call into agents and try to trip them up on disputes specifically. So you could hear her coaching and the actual consumer in the background. You could hear the exchange between them, and it was very clear that it became baiting. Then we did some further research, just starting with the phone number and the name, and found this website. And this website was not only built by, paid for, but was maintained financially by this law firm. And this person was supposed to be a credit repair specialist, but to this person's, I think this person didn't realize that it's actually not legal to pose as an attorney, but the website advertised this Wanda person as an attorney, and she was not. So we took every opportunity we had to get this in front of the judges out there, and judges were absolutely livid. So we attempted to take the deposition of that attorney, and that attorney pleaded the fifth to the entire deposition. So needless to say, we were awarded costs and have a current motion out for fees. To quote the judge is not playing hide the ball, end quote, on how she intends to rule on that particular motion based on the information that was received. There's another firm out of the 7th District that we basically same thing. Paul just started to pay a lot closer attention to the phone calls that were coming in related to disputes or very specific language that was consistent, where we could find that like the same exact sentence is being used in all of these phone calls, or locating patterns in the way that an account is handled and then disposition later, either as a dispute or a TCPA claim, things like that. This particular firm was paying what they call legal clerks $19,000 a month per seat, and they had up to 3 people working. So these are either like the most well-paid legal clerks in the history of time, or it was obviously a baiting situation. And as we were able to depose this third party company, which was hired by the firm to create these claims, we were able to determine that you know, obviously it was not exactly ethical. That one I'm being delicate about, obviously, because we still have some things outstanding with them. But yeah, I guess the point of that all, pay attention to trends that are happening in your phone calls. Pay attention to, the return addresses on the envelopes or the letters that are getting sent to your agencies. Common questions and how they're phrased, and even the consumer's reactions on the calls. You'd be absolutely shocked to find out how many of your bigger firms that we all know and love are doing this. And they're not really being that sneaky about it.
Wow.
Hey, Mike.
Yeah, go ahead, John.
This is John. One of the things we're seeing is is consumers using technology for baiting. We provide a speech analytics service to our clients, and we are finding that consumers are downloading apps to their phones, and these apps are designed to take over a phone call and to basically waste an agent's time, tricking the agent into thinking that they're really speaking with a human, when they're actually speaking to a bot that is being operated by the app on the phone of the consumer, who, instead of answering the phone, sends the call to a bot, which then begins to use an artificial voice to talk back and forth with an agent. And we see agents actually talking to these things because they're very clever and they're very good, these bots, and they're really... we have found they're really just designed to waste the agent's time. And this goes back to the first question we had about mistakes, and that is not training agents to be able to identify when they're being baited and when consumers are deliberately communicating for purposes other than to really resolve an account.
All right.
How is an agent, is an agent supposed to know when it goes from being a person to an app? Is there some way to tell? I mean, how do you sort of train your agent? How would an agency train its agents to kind of be aware of that situation?
Honestly, the best thing that you can do is play the call examples. You know, the questions are the same questions that you typically get every time on every call. So your best opportunity in training and preparing your collectors is to give them examples of those bots, give them examples of those apps so they can listen to it, they can hear the questions, you can print out the questions, because they're essentially the same each and every time someone uses that app.
Interesting. Somebody pointed out through the question that if you ask the bot, are you a person or a machine, the bot always says, I've never been asked that before. Maybe that's one way that, an agent can tell. So we've talked a little bit about baiting. I'd like to dive in a little bit more to the topic. You know, John, you brought up the bot issue. Are there other baiting traps that individuals are using today that you're seeing more of, or that are becoming more popular, or just so that you want to make people aware of? Renee, would you take that first, please?
Sure. Really, there's two key ones that we hear the most, and the first one is overshadowing. We're hearing people that want the question, when do I have to pay this by, specifically answered. And so we continue to educate our collectors, when someone is pressing you for a finite answer like that, you really have someone who is more than likely not interested in resolution of the debt, but interested in trapping you into a specific answer that more than likely is going to be misinformation. So if you have someone saying, when do I have to pay this by? And they're really looking for the collector to say, of course, by the end of the month, Friday, you know, again, some type of finite date, and the consumer knows that they, because they've received their initial notice letter, that it's within the first 30 days of placement, and they still have time to dispute the debt according to the FDCPA standards, that they're trying to trap them into overshadowing their debt opportunity. The other thing that we see is related to credit reporting, asking the collector, what do I have to do to get this off my credit report? And typically, you know, the collector's natural response is, well, you need to pay it, you know, which is not the only way that a trade line can be removed from a consumer's credit report. And so we've seen issues with that also. So, you know, our recommendation is to always redirect the conversation back to a debt resolution discussion. If someone's saying, when do I have to pay this by, we want them to go back and return to the conversation and the respective saying, well, when are you able to offer a payment on the account? Your balance is currently $200, and I can split that up into two payments for you. When are you able to make your first payment? And to avoid indicating any type of finite statement. So those are the two key ones that we're seeing, overshadowing and credit reporting statements.
Don, anything you want to add on top of that?
Those are the exact things we are seeing as well. And one of the things that we tell clients is, look, the law does not require you to answer every question a consumer asks. And so although it is courteous, although it is consumer friendly, what we try to get our clients to understand is, look, let's learn how to identify the hallmarks of a bait call, of a baiting call. And when you identify this call as a baiting call, then we're going to have a protocol to deal with it. The law does not require an agent to answer every question a consumer makes. And when the hallmarks of baiting calls begin to, you know, to come to light, you know, the catchphrase that I tell clients all the time, if the bait gets shown, get off the phone, right? You gotta be courteous. You have to have a protocol for ending the call. But when the agent learns that that caller or that recipient has no intention on focusing on the account or a dispute or anything legitimate, the best course of action is to politely and to gracefully get off the phone.
Right.
Yep, that's exactly right. I like that.
Speaking of ending calls, John, a question came in about the calls you were mentioned with respect to the bots or the apps that are being used. How should an agent end those type of calls?
Well, once they discover that they're not speaking to a human, I have not discovered that those bots are actually recording the call on their side. Once the agent thinks that they're not speaking to a human, then they can begin to ask questions. And when it becomes abundantly clear then after they ask the questions that they're not speaking to a human, I think it's okay to terminate the call in a polite way. I'm sorry I'm not able to help. If there's a better time that you'd like for us to call, please let me know when it might be more convenient for us to talk about this. And then when there's no response or some silly response from a bot, I'm okay with terminating the call at that point when you're not even talking to a human.
Okay, excellent. Good tip. Another question has come in. One thing we've started training our agents to do is when they get repeat questions, ask the consumer whether the consumer has an attorney. If the consumer admits having an attorney, we can get that information and end the call. The question is, what are your thoughts on this technique?
I know, I'm kind of chewing on that one. I don't know. I think if the conversation lends itself to asking that question, do you have an attorney? I would say there's nothing wrong with that. But if out of the blue, the agent just kind of inserts an assumption that the consumer has an attorney, my only concern, and obviously I'm still kind of vetting this one out, but my only concern is, does that then kind of turn the tables to make the, quote, confuse or mislead the consumer into believing that they should have an attorney? I'm just thinking like a plaintiff's attorney on that one. And I try to do that actually, to try to see what I would do to kind of turn it around. But I don't know if there's anything wrong with that. I mean, especially if they then answer back that they do have one. That's an interesting, that would be an interesting way to turn the conversation. But I guess I'm not sure how I feel about that one. I'd be curious, John and Renee.
Well, I guess my perspective on that is, if your collector is at the point where they feel like the question is appropriate for the situation, then the collector is at a point where they believe they're being baited. And if the collector is at a point where they believe they're being baited, then I would think that John's approach is the better approach, which is to just continue the call. That's the lane I would pick for our collectors, is to go ahead at that point, feel like they are being baited, they are in that situation, and either escalate the call to a supervisor or a manager who would be a more seasoned professional to make that determination, or to go ahead and disengage with the consumer. I'm not really sure what the complete benefit would be in taking that course of action.
Yeah, one of the things that we explain to clients is that repeat questions, the same question asked a different way over and over again by a consumer, in the face of an appropriate response the first time by the agent, we tell clients that behavior is a hallmark of a baiting call. When consumers ask the same question, expecting to get a different answer.
Right.
When we study lots of baiting calls, when we study them on balance, you know, baiting calls, you know, that is an ingredient or that is a hallmark of baiting calls. The same question over and over, expecting to get a different answer, sometimes later in the phone call. And that's something that we encourage agents to be mindful of. Hey, don't get tricked when they ask the question at the beginning of the call and you give them the appropriate answer. Then, you know, the middle of the call occurs, and then at the end of the call, you get that same question again. Be on guard. Make sure that, you know, your proper answer doesn't change just because they asked it a little bit differently. That's a warning sign, a red flag, something to be alert about.
Right.
We've gotten a few more questions asking if anybody knows the name, if any of you know the names of the apps or can share any more information. I guess they're people looking to sort of do some research to sort of better understand what they are. Is this anything that that anybody can share?
Oh, sure. There's an app called RoboKiller. And the icon looks like a robot with an antenna coming off of its head. That's the icon of the app on in the App Store. And quite literally, well, it's a purchased app, not surprisingly. You have to buy its service. But what happens after you purchase the app is you put your telephone number in there, and when you get an incoming call, you can tell the app to answer the call and commence the bot. And you can choose, I mean, there are like 50 or 100 different bots to choose from. If you want, you know, busy parent bot, then what will happen is the bot will answer the call. And the first thing the caller would hear is, hold on 1 second. And you'll hear a, you know, an upset child in the background. Hold on 1 second. Give me 1 second. And then, you know, and then 30 seconds will go by and you'll hear commotion in the background. And then the person will come back and said, oh, okay, I'm here. Tell me, who are you again? You know, it'll be a very disheveled bot. And the agent will, you know, it's actually believable when you hear this stuff. And then something else will interrupt the bot under the guise of having another family emergency. And another minute and a half will go by. And, you know, it's sort of like, tell me who you are again. I'm sorry. And that's sort of, that's just one of like 100 different scripts you can choose from. There's another, you know, there are other scripts that we have found in our speech analytics where, you know, the bot begins to ask, very pointed questions and, you know, why are you calling me and who consented? What's the source of your consent for you to call me? Well, you know, are you recording this call? And, you know, on and on. And you know, and the agent's responding, well, yes, we are. That was the recording disclosure that I gave you. And that's an example. And so RoboKiller is the one we're seeing a lot in the recordings that we're analyzing.
Got it. Thank you. Another question come in. If a debtor calls the debt collector during the 30-day debt validation notice period and inquires about how, when to make a payment, should the debt collector provide payment details on the call, or can that be construed as overshadowing?
Well,
I'll take it. Go ahead. Is that Shelley? Go ahead.
No, that's fine, John. I can piggyback off of you. Go ahead.
Okay. You know, in response to questions like that, you know, I encourage, first the thing I encourage agencies to do is I think it's important for agents to know whether they're inside or outside the validation period. And I think technology can help agents to learn that. And so I encourage clients that to the extent they can tell their collection platform to make their agent aware on whether the account is inside or outside the validation notice, that to me is step one. And that's an easy thing to do technologically. The second thing is in response to questions about, you know, payments, say, look, my system indicates your balance is $543 and I can help you make a payment if you'd like. you know, how can I help you make a payment or something like that? You know, again, we don't have to answer every single question a consumer asks. We can ask, we can answer the question maybe that we wanted the consumer to ask. And simply by offering, you know, my system indicates that the balance is this, how can I help you make a payment? I think that gets you comfortably away from overshadowing. We have learned that there's a phenomenon that happens between the time words pass the lips of an agent and in between the distance between the lips and the consumer's ears, something causes those words to mutate. And the consumer hears something different than the words that came out of the agent's mouth. And so if we can try and avoid language, timing language, I call it, then that helps to, you know, at least dissipate the impact of word mutation by the time it hits the consumer's ear. But I like for agents to know whether or not they are inside the validation period when they're communicating with the consumer. And when they are inside the validation period, to be especially sensitive to words of timing when they talk to consumers.
Right. I mean, as collectors, we're taught to create a sense of urgency, right? And so our collectors are constantly in that mindset. And so in that initial 30-day period, their approach needs modification. And so what's important is watching definitive terminology. You have to make a payment by the end of the month. This settlement must be paid by Friday. You know, any of those words that indicate that it must take place by a certain time, and if it's not, you know, then there could be that the settlement won't be available anymore. This payment arrangement would become null and void. I mean, even if they're not using those specific terms, using definitive words like you must pay it, it has to be paid by, are still conveying those ideas to the consumer. What we would like for the collector to do is say, are you able to make this payment by Friday? If the consumer says no, you know, I could make it by the first, then we can say, great, well, then let's go ahead and set that. How much could you pay by Friday if you're not able to pay the entire, you know, balance? So really it's phrasing your questions appropriately, phrasing the payment opportunities appropriately. And again, as I stated before, avoiding putting a finite date on it or using definitive statements or words that can be construed as telling the consumer they have to pay something when they're still within their 30 days of dispute opportunity.
Excellent. Okay. And a question just came in on that with respect to what are your payment options? Is that question in reference to payment options regarding paying the balance in full, or if there are payment plans, or if it's talking about ways to pay like Visa, MasterCard, check by phone, mail, et cetera?
It can be either. You know, you can say to the consumers, your balance is $200. Is that something that you're able to pay? If they say, no, I don't have the balance, then you can say, what are you able to pay? And if they, whatever the case is, but yeah, I mean, it would also indicate the opportunity to pay it over the phone. So, but a lot of it is asking the consumer during that 30 days, ensuring that you're leaving the options available, the opportunity available for the consumer to reject it, as opposed to saying that, well, if you're going to pay, you know, two payments of $100, I'm going to need you to go ahead and do that over the phone. You know, so again, we would be making a statement that indicates they have to do it the way that we're stating they need to do it, and thereby closing the door on their 30-day opportunity to dispute, which would be overshadowing. So if they say no, we say I can go ahead and get that represented for you in a payment over the phone. Would you like to take care of it with a Visa debit card, Visa or MasterCard or debit card or credit card? They say no, I want to put it in the mail. You know, we can either tell them why it's better for them to pay it over the phone, or if they insist on sending it in the mail, then that's what they're going to need to do, because we have no reason to demand that they represent it over the phone. So, I mean, really, the answer to the question is both. You know, payment options can be how they break up their payments or how they elect to pay it.
Got it. Thank you. Question about whether you advise or recommend collectors use aliases when speaking with individuals. Is that something that that you approve of or prefer they don't do?
That one, you have to be careful. There are states that don't allow you to use aliases. There are states that specifically require the aliases either be approved or listed with them before you're able to use them. So you've got to be very careful about that. So you can look into each state and its licensing requirements. Typically, it will mention the use of either an alias or fictitious name, and they'll specify whether that's relevant to the company or to the agents themselves. So that's a sticky one. You've got to definitely be specific to the state and make your determination that way.
Okay. A question coming in from the audience. Can you please talk about accepting a payment for an out for repossession account? Does anyone want to try and tackle that one?
No.
I know. We don't service those kinds. So.
Very succinct, John.
Is this where we're allowed to swear?
Yeah. There's a whole lot more. There's a whole lot more information and context I think we would need in order to provide any meaningful response to that. When we start talking about repossession, we're also beginning to talk about state law rules as well. And so that's. An answer to that question, it doesn't yield itself to a very short analysis.
Not a problem. Another question. What are the best ways for a collector to identify if a consumer is disputing a debt?
I'm interested in Shelley and Renee's response. I tell clients, my dog ate my homework, I don't owe the debt. I tell them that's a dispute.
I try to be very sensitive to the different variances of dispute. If it's the amount, if it's the, if it's the whole thing, if there's, I can't pay this right now, you know, press pause and, see if we can't review the account better. But, there's just so much case law that gives us such a broad, broad definition that it's actually kind of unfortunate. I don't know if we can really name anything, or all of them, I guess, all on here.
I think that...
And it's important.
Yeah, okay. Go ahead.
The consumer doesn't have to use the word dispute. Most people on the call probably realize that. Training agents to listen for the word dispute, yes, is important, but they certainly don't have to use the word dispute. Like I think I paid that already. They didn't use the word dispute, but they're actually raising a question about the validity or the amount that's actually due.
So I think that we take a more liberal approach than saying that it's a dispute and kind of saying, okay, we're going down that lane. Because I do, and I'm going to say it's going to depend on the lines of business that you have within your company. But we do have a lot of lines of business, medical, telecom, utility, those types of things, where the consumer legitimately may not know that they had a final billing statement out there, did not know perhaps that their insurance, their medical insurance, didn't cover a portion of the bill. And so their initial response when you talk to them about the fact that they have an outstanding balance is, I don't think I owe that, you know? And so I like to take the approach that education is first. You need to take a moment to educate the consumer as to the nature of the debt and why they owe it. And if the consumer still believes that there's some dispute to it, I always like to ask the question as to what is the nature of their dispute. Oftentimes we can work through that. I think that people legitimately want to pay what they believe they legitimately owe. If you have someone who is disputing in terms of using it as a stall tactic, they're not interested in paying their debt. You do have people who think that they have legitimate concerns and they are disputing it legitimately and they need paperwork or itemized bills or something that can support the debt that the client is saying they owe, and they are looking for some legitimized substantiation of the bill. And then you have people that are just confused and need education. And so I think that it's important that our collectors are educated or trained appropriately so they can make critical decisions as to what type of consumer they have on the phone and are able to make the right decision on how the account should be handled. That's our take on disputes.
Thank you for sharing. Renee, coming back to you, we've talked a lot about, sort of the issues or how a mistake gets made. I'm curious, what is the best way that you found to get collectors to correct mistakes and to train them to keep those mistakes from happening again?
So when I saw this question, I think, are you saying if a collector realizes during the course of the conversation with the consumer that they've made an error, or do you mean in terms of remediation?
I'll steal your answer from before and say both.
Well, I believe if a consumer realizes that they've made an error in terms of providing information to a consumer during the course of the call, they need to tell the consumer they've made an error. And I think that it's important that we immediately own what we recognize and we recorrect. If we've given somebody some type of misinformation and we realize that we have the opportunity to provide them correct information, I think it's vital that we do that immediately. I think that part of my job is to protect consumers from harm. And so we don't want to leave a consumer thinking one thing when we have the opportunity to rectify it and tell them the correct thing. The same with disclosures. You know, if a collector realizes I didn't give the debt collector disclosure and I'm a minute into the call, go ahead and give it. You know, it's fine. Fix your error. It's okay. We all make mistakes, but let's work through it when we realize it happens. In terms of remediation, we remediate both through bonus offsets and progressive discipline. So our goal through compliance and quality assurance is strictly related to policy adherence and regulatory adherence. And all of our policies are built around regulation, federal, state, local law. And so as we go through the course of a call or as we examine an account, we're looking to see how that call or how that account was managed. And if we find that there was a violation in terms of policy adherence, we practice the point system in which the collectors accumulate point value, which is a bad thing. And we remediate, like I said, through bonus offsets and progressive discipline that encourage the collector to fix their mistakes. And we do it daily. So as soon as we observe the policy violation, we let our collectors know right away. And believe that real-time coaching is really imperative to helping collectors right set their path and ensure that they feel comfortable going into a conversation, understanding their compliance expectations. Did I answer both?
Yes, you did. Thank you. We've only got a couple of minutes left. But there are a bunch of questions here in the queue. Many of them are related to disputes, which I anticipate that will be a future AccountsRecovery.net webinar in the not too distant future, just given the nature and quantity of questions that are here. Let's see if we can get through a couple of these before we run out of time. Here's one that's not related to disputes. Is anyone using a novel approach to confirm the identity of a debtor on the call without running the risk of a third party disclosure? For example, not asking for the last four digits of a social security number or for date of birth, et cetera.
We do not, we authenticate using first and last name. We do not request for an additional authenticator.
Okay. A question about overshadowing. For calls that occur during the validation period, can collectors inoculate, great word, themselves from overshadowing claims by reminding consumers they have 30 days to dispute the debt from the date they receive the validation notice?
John, I think
That gives me pause. It gives me pause, not because it can't be done properly, but because doing it properly requires a level of precision that I don't often see on the floor. And so, maybe what you would ask instead is for the consumer to confirm that they received the letter. And now you can, now you have confirmation that they did get the disclosure in the way that the company wants that disclosure provided. And we don't have to rely on agents to try and rephrase or repeat that disclosure on the phone, which I think is, the risk of human error when we're beginning to now repeat, those disclosures on the phone, I think increases dramatically. Doesn't mean it can't be done. It just means you have to have a level of precision that, requires a whole lot more sort of training and assurance.
Does it matter if it's an incoming or outgoing call?
Not to me, it doesn't. I don't think the risk changes, no.
No.
I agree with that.
Let's see here. Can you provide an example of a disclosure statement for that familiar consumer? I think we're talking about before when you're having a conversation with the same consumer over and over again. Is there a different disclosure statement that a collector should give?
No. ERC's opinion is that you stick to that disclosure, and even if the consumer is uncomfortable hearing it, you just simply say, I understand you've heard this before, but unfortunately the law does require that we give you these disclosures. We absolutely don't, allow our collectors to deviate from that.
I agree. I mean, the reality is, and they can make the statement, unfortunately I can't continue with the conversation until I provide you with the disclosures that I'm required to give you.
Here's another script and looking for feedback. What do you think about the scripting? While I will be happy to mark your account disputed now, to more fully protect your rights, you should send us your dispute in writing. We are required to respond to written disputes.
That one sends up a little bit of a red flag for me because we've actually, that is almost direct, like that almost exactly matches some of the language that was used to try to create the lawsuits from that third party in New York, because just because Pennsylvania requires it in writing doesn't mean everybody requires it in writing. And there's definitely states like California is one of them where we got multiple suits. New York definitely will not tolerate the requirement of it being in writing. I would just avoid that if you can. That's our stance. Then that's based on our experience, of course.
Excellent. Well, we're a couple of minutes past 2 o'clock, which is when I promised our panelists we would end. So I don't want to take up too much more of their time, but I do want to offer them an extra special thank you for today. We had a list of discussion topics that we were going to go through, but there were so many questions that came in that we really didn't get to any of the discussion topics we had come up with. Instead, they spent most of their time answering these questions, which were great. But I think an extra special thank you for Renee, Shelley, and John for answering these things sort of off the top of their head and providing some very comprehensive and insightful answers. So I really appreciate that. Thank you for ad-libbing and doing such a great job today. I also wanted to thank Chris Brickman at Peak Revenue Learning for sponsoring today's webinar. Please go to peakrevenuelearning.com to learn more about the company. Thanks to everybody who participated and asked questions. One final reminder, please take a minute and fill out the feedback survey for today's webinar. I really appreciate your insights. Please stay tuned to accountsrecovery.net for news and more webinars in the very near future. I hope everyone enjoys the rest of the day. Shelley, John, Renee, thank you guys so much. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you, Mike.
Excellent. We'll talk to everybody soon. Take care.
Thank you.